Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday morning at the Milwaukee Art Museum right now, and running until January 13th is an absolutely beautiful exhibition. It's titled Rembrandt, Van Dyck, Gainsborough, The Treasures of Kenwood House, and is a collection of 48 masterpieces, including Rembrandt's late self-portrait from 1665. The collection is usually housed at Kenwood House outside London and was donated to England by Edward Cecil Guinness, who was a wealthy guy because he was heir to the world's most successful brewery. Kenwood House is being refurbished, and the exhibition is on tour, and Milwaukee is lucky enough to be one of four places that has a chance to see this exhibition, which is, as I said, terrific. We want to tell you and remind you during the course of this hour that we have a couple tickets to this exhibition, which we are going to ask you to do this in order to possibly receive them. If you would email us at talk@WPR.org, and then we'll put all of your names into a drawing, and we'll let you know if you are the winner. You'll have a chance to see this exhibition. We have two people with us, and Rhonda and I had the great pleasure of going through the exhibition last week with our two guests, who were so informative. We'll learn a great deal about all of these paintings and what it's like to put together an exhibition of this magnitude this hour of the program. Susan Jenkins is joining us by phone. She was in Milwaukee last week. She is joining us by phone from New York this morning. She is senior curator at the English Heritage Foundation. She's a graduate of the Gonville and Caius College at Cambridge University and Courtauld Institute of Art in London. She's an expert scholar of the history of collecting and has done extensive work in historic houses. And we are delighted to have her with us. Good morning to you, Susan.
Good morning. Good morning.
Yeah, nice to have you here, and thanks so much for the grand tour last week. It was just terrific. William Rudolph is also joining us. William is curator of American art and decorative arts at the Milwaukee Art Museum. He has been all over the country. He was curator of American art at the Worcester Art Museum for a number of years, also at the Dallas Museum of Art, and he began his curatorial career at the Philadelphia Museum of Art, where he worked in the departments of European painting before 900. He has been at many other places teaching courses in European and American art history. William, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, and it's lovely to welcome back my colleague and friend Susan Jenkins.
Yeah, you two were terrific. We learned so much and it's such a beautiful collection. And it is, I understand, it was your biggest opening weekend ever. So a lot of people want to see these paintings.
We were thrilled with the numbers. It was our most successful opening weekend. We've started tracking since the opening of the Quadracci Pavilion. That sort of was the game changer for us. And we're just thrilled that people have wanted to come in and see these wonderful paintings that English Heritage has made available to us. So please do keep coming. We're just absolutely over the moon that enough people have responded to the quality of these extraordinary works, and I'm sure we'll have the chance to tell your listeners just why these works are so wonderful of their kind.
They have not been let out of England very often. Is this the first time ever to America, or have they been here before, Susan?
No, it's the first time ever to America. Individual works have been requested for specific exhibitions, but this touring group has never been let out of the country, as you say. It usually resides at Kenwood House, and it's only because Kenwood is closed for a refurbishment program, having a new roof and new work on the facades, that we've had to close the house, and we're so thrilled that they're touring. I mean, they are incredibly high-quality paintings. They are worthy of, you know, an international showing absolutely anywhere. And it has been a thrill how welcoming Milwaukee has been to them. I was so touched and delighted to see the public interest. And I do hope, as William said, that the exhibition is a complete sellout.
I would imagine that it'll be close to it. Tell me about the paintings and how they happen to be housed at Kenwood and what Kenwood is. It's an interesting story.
Quite, yes. Kenwood is was a 17th century house that was renovated in the 18th century by Robert Adam for a patron, William Murray, 1st Earl of Mansfield. The Mansfield family lived in it until the 1920s. It's in a completely beautiful site. It's on the edge of Hampstead Heath. So if you're visiting, please don't visit until it reopens in October 2013. But you can walk across the heath on a beautiful day, I would hope, and go to the cafe at Kenwood and then go into the house. The paintings themselves were bought, as you said in your opening phrases, by Edward Cecil Guinness. He was the great-grandson of Arthur Guinness, who founded the Guinness Brewing Company in Ireland. And we thought that Milwaukee in particular, with its brewing interests, might welcome a collection founded on brewing money. In the late 19th century, so from 1880s, Edward Guinness sold his family company and had a lot of money and basically bought a house in London that he wanted to furnish. So he went shopping on Bond Street and bought, in the period 1887 to 91, he bought over 200 works of art. Ooh. For his London property. They weren't housed at Kenwood House until the 1930s because Edward Guinness bought Kenwood House in 1925 with a view to housing his collection there, but he was never able to because he died in 1927. So after his death, his will said, I want this house filled, well, he bequeathed 63 paintings, and you've got 48 in this exhibition, so the kind of the cream of the crop. He said, I want Kenwood House open forever, every day, free of charge to the public, so that they can enjoy this collection, and that's the spirit, that's what we do now.
Can you imagine having that money and just walking through London and buying all those paintings?
It's
just hard to imagine. I'll bet you would.
That would be a curator's dream come true.
Absolutely.
And the interesting thing, as Susan brings out in her exhibition catalog, is that, of course, Lord Ivo wasn't the only person who was doing this at the time. It was actually quite an exciting competitive moment for people interested in collecting old masters, which, you know, I like the broader definition of old masters to include, for example, the greatest hits of British art, such as are in the exhibition, because there were Americans who were quite interested in doing this. Henry Clay Frick, Mr. Huntington, these are the great nuclei of some of the extraordinary art collections in this country. And of course, at home, Lord Ivo was sort of egged on, if you will, perhaps by the competitive spirit of families like the Rothschilds, the great Jewish bankers, who were also quite eager at this time period to fill their great houses with very much the same works of art, particularly Dutch and Flemish, and certainly 18th century French as well.
Yes, as William says, it was very competitive between America and Britain at the time. And actually, the obituaries for Lord Ivor mentioned that he had swiped paintings from under the noses of people like Henry Clay Frick. And I went to the Frick yesterday, and I went into their room of British portraits of English ladies. And I thought, they've got better in Milwaukee at the moment.
They do have that one kind of wonderful big Gainsborough, don't they?
Yes.
But then, of course, Kenwood has a very wonderful big gains. Actually, several, and two of them are visiting us right now.
Yes.
Let's talk about what I think is the centerpiece, and that's the portrait, a late self-portrait of Rembrandt. It is just such a beautiful painting. I was with a friend of mine teaches at UW-Milwaukee, and she said, I've been teaching about this painting for years and years and years, and here it is right in front of me. And she was just ecstatic. To me, there, I could have stood there, and I think I did. I left the tour for just a couple minutes so I could take it in, and I'll go back to see that painting. It's one of those that kind of fills your soul, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm. It's very much a moving, incredible image of oneself. As Susan points out very, very clearly, Rembrandt self-portraits are self-portraits, but they're also constructions of himself, perhaps in a marketing sense, sort of the way he broadcasts his own image as an artist. And Susan explains this much better than I can. But as an image of old age, as an image of someone who is looking into a mirror and recording what he is, what he's come to, as a summation, it's extraordinary. It's very brave, I think, to do that sort of a project, to be that candid and that penetrating. And so I actually get quite choked up when I see that painting, because I just become filled with feelings of sort of tenderness and awe, and think about how lucky one is if one can get to that age and be that sort of open about self-interrogation.
Yes, and he paints himself in the act of painting, which is quite rare. Artists don't always paint themselves with their palette and their paintbrushes in their hand. This, I think, is Rembrandt's legacy self-portrait. It isn't the last self-portrait that he painted of himself, but it's the last large portrait where he's actually depicts himself in a very dignified way in the act of painting. And I would like to congratulate William and his colleagues at the Milwaukee Art Museum for the way they've created a little chapel to him, in a way. You can actually step aside and commune with Rembrandt. It's also hung quite low, much lower than we can hang it in a historic house, which has dados and cornices and, you know, architectural features that you have to respect. So you can actually walk up and look into his eyes and sort of commune with his soul, if you like.
And that was actually the first thing we knew, for sure, when we were working with our very talented exhibition designer, David Russick, and he came up with an idea of the floor plan, because, of course, our Baker Rowland galleries are raw space, and we can reconfigure them, budget allowing, any way we want. And so there was this little chapel, if you will, but the first thing we knew when we looked at that little chapel was that's where the Rembrandt's going to go. That's, David had created this aha moment for us, and he didn't necessarily, as the designer, know what was going to be in there. But my colleague Catherine Sawinski, the assistant curator of earlier European art, and I just immediately took the little sort of model of the Rembrandt. And this is the fun of playing with design. It's like Barbie's dream house. You move these little markers around in a model. We took it and we went, ding, right there. We knew that was where it all began. And everything else sort of wonderfully flowed out from there. And thank you, Susan, for agreeing with us that it's a great aha moment for the visitor. We really appreciate that.
And how did you decide what color the wall would be there?
That really was, the designer had, so David had some ideas, and we had some ideas, and I sort of, one thing I gave him, you know, the not so helpful guiding principle of, I don't want gray, I hate yellow, and can we please not have brown? Because oftentimes when you visit galleries of 17th century Dutch and Flemish paintings, what do? They go straight for the brown. It's sort of, you know, it's, and it's effective. But so those were my sort of not very helpful and somewhat autocratic principles. And he came up with some really marvelous suggestions, including that sort of burgundy color that I think sets the Rembrandt off rather well.
What he's actually done is reflect the palette that Kenwood House itself has. He's seen photographs, obviously, of where the Rembrandt hangs currently, and it's in a sort of dark red space. Also, the rest of the exhibition palette, there's a kind of pale blue that was used by Robert Adam in many of the interiors, particularly the Great Rimmel Library. So for me, I feel immediately very at home, not just with the paintings that, you know, have come from my home base, but in the sort of environment that you've created for them here.
Mm-hmm. Now, Rembrandt was not a painter who made a lot of money in his lifetime. Am I right about that? He was, some of the other people who were exhibited were doing pretty well. The court had commissioned them to do paintings of people in the family, et cetera, et cetera. Did Rembrandt have any big source of income during his lifetime or not?
No, you're quite right. And at the time that he painted that self-portrait, he was bankrupt and he was working He was working for his son, Titus. Some artists do well in their lifetime, and then their reputation wanes. Rembrandt did moderately well, but had huge ups and downs, and then, you know, basically couldn't sustain an income, and he was worried about how he would pay for his mistress's burial and all these kind of really significant worries that I think you can see on his face in the painting. But of course, now, and when Lord Ivor bought the painting in 1888, Rembrandt's star is completely in the ascendant, and, you know, along with Van Gogh, Rembrandt's prices reach the highest, you know, of any works of art in the world.
And what's quite interesting to piggyback on that is that the exhibition gives the visitor multiple stories. And one story that we didn't bring out in the labels, but we could certainly bring out in a tour, it's the economics of an artist's career. So whereas in his own lifetime, as Susan points out, Rembrandt was not successful, but of course now is a rock star of artists, price-wise and art historically wise, somebody like Sir Joshua Reynolds or George, I'm thinking in particular of George Romney, who was, you know, one of the great 18th century British portrait painters. But today, I mean, people who love 18th century portraiture like me love Romney and love Reynolds. But of course, they made quite good livings during their lifetime. But, you know, the auction value, if you will, if we have to be sort of tacky and think about these apples and oranges, today there's a marked difference in the sort of market value of these paintings.
Hmm. So why isn't it a forever artist always? Why didn't people realize when they saw this self-portrait of Rembrandt, oh my gosh, this is a knockout piece and it forever will be? I don't understand how fortunes can wane.
Well, tastes change over time. I mean, Rembrandt was a very, very prolific artist. Mm. He painted over 60 self-portraits. And in fact, I mean, some of them weren't actually self-portraits. It was obviously him as a figure, but he dressed himself up in... He was playing with image, and he dressed himself up in sort of strange clothes and so on. He also painted very impressionistically, very big blobs of paint, very sort of thick impasto encrusted canvases, and he painted a lot. So there was, you know, the demand probably wasn't there, and the appreciation of his technique. And people in the 17th century Dutch art world, the sort of smaller homes like to collect finely painted small cabinet pieces. So Rembrandt, with these big sloshy paintings, didn't really, you know, hit the spot. It's only now that we realize, you know, post the era of Impressionism, that like Velázquez, the people whose works you have to stand back in order to get the whole sense, we appreciate that kind of painting much better than the narrowly academic, fine, figurative work, I think.
Mm-hmm. You've talked about portrait painting being something that you absolutely love. There are some beautiful portraits. If you would like to take wherever you want to begin with this and talk about the portraits, and there are so many stories, who did the sittings, who was commissioned to do a portrait, who the portraits were of, but they are beautiful.
Well, the exhibition is rich in portraits, incredibly rich in portraits, as is the collection at Kenwood House. And one is able to go through the exhibition and look at a great artist, Sir Anthony Van Dyck, who is a court painter in the 17th century at the court of Charles I. He's actually Flemish, but he really helps inaugurate a certain tradition in portraiture in Great Britain. And there are two extraordinary examples of his work in the exhibition, one of which had belonged to Charles I, actually, who was one of the great art collectors of Europe in the early modern period. And the exhibition allows you to trace then that pathway through well into the 18th century, which particularly in London was an incredibly competitive art market, very competitive, with a great demand for portraiture. And the exhibition reflects the diversity of artists who were working in this very competitive market, but also changing ideas, sometimes conflicting ideas, about what a portrait should be and the role it should play. So the portraits actually look differently, even though some of them are executed at the same time. So I think it's fascinating from an art historical perspective and a connoisseur perspective to see there is the way that Sir Joshua Reynolds ennobles his sitters by dressing up women as goddesses. And yet on the other side, there is Thomas Gainsborough, who is aestheticizing his sitters through absolutely marvelous feathery brushwork and suggesting a sort of linkage of the sitter with nature and wonderful flowing clothes and wavy hair, and yet these are operating at the exact same time at different ends of the spectrum. They're drawing from the same client base, and they're involved in the same nascent and then young art institutions in London.
And some of these paintings are huge, Susan.
Well, that's true. One in particular, sort of also tying into your last question, Thomas Gainsborough's Countess Howe. Mm-hmm. It's actually over 8 feet tall. Oh. So I know that it was a challenge for the wall space in the Milwaukee Art Museum. But that represents both the sort of ego of the sitter, if you like, and the ego of the artist, because it was painted in about 1764 in the spa town of Bath, which was a society hangout for people who wanted to take the waters and meet all their friends outside of London. And it was only the third full-length portrait that Gainsborough had painted. And so he had moved to Bath himself to try and catch more commissions, to get more society work, so he's done that in Countess Howe. And the sitter wants to establish herself as a major, important figure in society, which the portrait does for her. I mean, it's one of the most beautiful portraits in the exhibition, in my view. It's quite an early Gainsborough. It's very, very big, as I said. But she still looks feminine. She's wearing a pink dress. She's got beautiful ruffled lace at her elbow and kind of around her her chest. And as William said, Gainsborough enjoys feathery brushstrokes in the landscape, but her face he paints with great precision, and it's one of the most beautiful paintings I think you'll see anywhere in the world. So please, Milwaukee, do go and see it.
And when you say she wanted to establish herself as a sitter, she wanted to establish herself, and what would it mean to be established?
Sorry, no, I meant that she wanted to establish herself as an important society person. Hmm. And one of the attributes of trappings of doing that was to have your portrait painted. Hmm. So she sat to Gainsborough for this wonderful, enormous portrait, which then she would show off to all her friends in her, you know, at home. And she also, her husband also sat as well for a separate portrait, which we no longer have, which was much more modest, because she has a very dominant stance, as you'll see in the, yes, the painting. Her husband sort of, you know, fades into the background very much.
And you also have to understand, Susan points out that these works were shown off in their homes, and also many of them had their debut in public at, for example, the Royal Academy, where people would go and see them. And oftentimes the sitters might be only identified by initials, Mrs. So-and-so, but people knew who they were. And what's really fantastic about the exhibition is we see examples of people who are using portraiture to construct images of themselves. So here is Mrs. Howe announcing that she is a big deal, literally and figuratively. And then we have a painting that both Susan and I like very much of Emma Hart as a spinstress.
Spinning.
Thank you. And there's a marvelous story behind that. It's all about branding and image management, if you will. And Susan, maybe you can explain why this portrait is sort of cheeky and wonderful.
Well, yes. I think, William, you suggested Emma Hart was the Kim Kardashian of her age.
Yes.
This painting was painted by George Rumney in the 1780s. Emma Hart was already... She was a lady of extremely ill repute. She'd been an actress. She'd had various affairs. The portrait was commissioned by the lover she was living with, and it was painted just before this lover, Charles Granville, sent her off to Naples because he couldn't afford her. And he sent her off to be with his uncle, William Hamilton, the British consul in Naples, who ended up marrying her before she had an affair with Admiral Lord Nelson and a love child with him.
Woo.
So she was, but here she's painted it wearing white, veiled, sitting at spinning with a chicken in a very domestic, modest, reputable environment, whiter than white, holier than innocence itself, which she clearly was not. And what I like, when we walked around the show, we realized that many of the ladies who are all hanging together would have known each other or of each other. But Emma Hart, if she walked into a room with those other beauties, they would have walked out. They would not have been able, they would, you know, socially, they could not have known each other.
I think she was the greatest beauty of the lot, though. There's something about her face that is just gorgeous.
Well, George Romney agreed with you, the artist, because he was obsessed with her and painted her over and over again.
You'll always recognize her, by the way, now that you've seen the portrait, because you'll see images of her as Susan said, Romney repeatedly painted her. But she was a beauty of the day, a notorious beauty. And you will see multiple representations of her in various collections, and you'll always recognize her because it's a very lovely, distinctive face. Don't you agree?
Yeah, she's got very sort of doe eyes.
Yes.
And she was famous for her attitude. She was an actress. So she used to kind of dress up in sort of different veils and costumes and perform for people. And all the time, her beautiful face is fixed on you in a sort of performance.
Oh, the backstory on these paintings is almost as good as the paintings themselves, huh? We welcome phone calls if you'd like to join our conversation at the Milwaukee Art Museum right now, running until January 13th of 2013. Rembrandt Van Dyck, Gainsborough, The Treasures of Kenwood House. And we are talking this hour with two guests who took us on a tour and some other people about a week ago. It's really an exhibit well worth seeing. Joining us by phone from New York City is Susan Jenkins, senior curator at the English Heritage Foundation, and William Rudolph is with us, curator of American art and decorative arts at the Milwaukee Art Museum. Here's our phone number if you'd like to join the conversation. I hope a few of you have seen this exhibit already and can give us your impressions. I know it's early in its run. It opened October 12, but call us if you've seen it, or call if you have comments about the exhibit, the museum, getting the paintings here, this time in art in the world. We'd love to hear from you. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. You can also, we have two tickets, and we are doing sort of a drawing for these. If you would like to email us at talk@wpr.org, we'll put all your emails together, and then we'll put them in a hat. If we have a hat, we'll put them in a bowl or something, and then we will draw a winner. And you'll have a chance to see this exhibit, which runs again through January 13. So, on we go. Deadline is 10 a.m. Thanks. 10 a.m., so you have a half hour. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our phone number again is 800-486-8655. Hour two of our program you won't want to miss, particularly those of you who are going to polling sites now as the election is getting pretty close. This guy is fabulous. He's a young gentleman who started his prediction career and statistics career in the field of baseball. And now he, for the 2008 election, he got every state right but one, which is pretty amazing. Nate Silver, who is the 538 blogger, his pieces appear in the New York Times now, and he's written a book about predictions, all kinds of predictions, from volcanoes to elections to forecasts, why some forecasts work and some don't. His book is The Signal in the Noise, Why So Many Predictions Fail But Some Don't. He will be with us hour two of the show.
Can we get him to weigh in on exhibition ideas, perhaps? because sometimes it is, you know, quite a gamble. But we're happy that Kenwood House does not seem to be a gamble.
I'll ask him that question. That will take us into a whole new field. Thank you for the suggestion.
Have him contact us. We really enjoy that conversation at some meetings that we have, wouldn't we?
All right, good. We'll do that. And before we go to a couple phone calls here, let's talk about the backstory of some of these paintings, because it is interesting that they are just so riveting, some of them. And I'm wondering how, when you're putting an exhibit together, you get that backstory, too. How do you do that?
It's quite a combination. There is a catalog, and the catalog provides a certain story. And then also, of course, you have your labels, which provide a certain story. And then you also have, we offer at the Milwaukee Art Museum, then an audio tour where you're able to go into greater length. And I think Susan will agree with me that these are all three different things that work together, and there are different tones that you take, perhaps, and different amounts of information. Because ultimately, you don't want to get in the way of the works of art. At least I don't, as a curator. You want to sort of give people enough. It's like a seasoning where you shake enough on your dish to make it spicy and tasty, but you don't want to overwhelm. And that's a tricky balance.
Yes, you're quite right. I mean, layering of information, depending on what people want. But you don't get the backstory unless you actually, you know, look for it in a way. And I would also like to say that the docent program at the Milwaukee Art Museum of training docents, and they take tours, I understand, that works very well. I think if you're taken on a good tour with someone who can give you that insight that will just really pique your interest and make you want to learn more, that's a very good way of engaging with your art as well.
Well, I had the best, you and William.
Oh, well, thank you.
Doesn't get better than that. No, it was great. Our number, 800-486-8655, Don in Milwaukee. Hi, Don.
Oh, hi, good morning. I'm just going to pull over so I don't break any more laws.
Thanks, Don.
I saw the exhibit. I've still got Rembrandt's self-portrait staring into my soul. You can't get it out of your mind. And the whole thing is that the children's room is that bright, well, not red, but anyway, that dark reddish color, and those pictures. My question is, how do you not get overwhelmed by going to an art exhibit so that you have to come back every day and look at a different print, a different painting, which is nice, but you can't do that. How do you go from one painting to another and sort of, you know, cleanse your palate, you know, like when you're drinking wine, so that you can appreciate it more than you do just by getting so overwhelmed and saying, this is too much, it's wonderful, but I can't appreciate it.
Well, of course, we want that to happen to you. We want you to come back. I mean, the simplest answer is you become a member of that institution, and your membership at the Milwaukee Art Museum, shameless plug, but this is wonderful what we do. We do not upcharge for special exhibitions. Members see exhibitions free. So with your annual membership, at whatever level, that provides you access every day that we're open, every hour that we're open, when you can come, to seeing an exhibition. So that's one of the great, I would say, arguments and virtues of being a member at your own institution, which is that, you know, over the course of the run of a show, you can feel free to come back and spend quality time engaging, slow looking, it's like slow food, with one or two works of art and not feel pressured. That doesn't always happen when you travel. Of course, we understand that. But if you are local, it's a wonderful, wonderful way to do that at your leisure, at your convenience, you know, and I think really sort of savor the multiple layers.
Well, the exhibit's been there since the 12th of October, and you put a lot of planning into this. What do you do on a day-to-day basis? Do you go see one painting every day, or do you take a couple days off? Work there.
I do actually look at art every day. I'm very lucky that I work in an art museum, and I think Susan would agree with me. We have fabulous jobs, you know.
Oh, yes.
But I do try to do that. Now, I pop into Kenwood every day because it's like a child and I want to see how my child is doing in school, as it were. But I also go into my permanent collection galleries and I like to look at different things at different times. You know, sometimes there are days that certain paintings don't agree with you and there are days that you seek out other works of art because you just really want to look at them. That's my method. Susan, you may have a different one.
Well, yes, no, I agree. And actually coming back to Don and his feeling of it being overwhelmed, I mean, William and I, we look at a lot of art because it's sort of the job, and I have no problem with singling out a favorite, and each time you go back, which I think is a very sensible idea, you can choose another favorite, because what I think the best experience is not, well, to get an overview, buy the catalog, read up at home, then go back to look at the works of art for yourself, and each time you'll probably find something in a different work that sings to you. Often, if I go to an exhibition with lots and lots of works of art or a museum, when I leave, I have one or two paintings that I've really connected with and that remain in my mind. And I think that is a very valid learning experience.
So what is your favorite in the exhibit?
My favorite in the exhibit? Well, I have quite a few of them.
Susan, what's your favorite?
Yes, I was thinking. For some reason, I wasn't expecting that question. I'm very fond, in the children's room, of Louisa Murray, painted by Sir Thomas Lawrence, who was George IV's premier painter. And he loves glamour, and he's painted this little, innocent, impish child completely beautifully. So I'm very fond of her because she's got a very interesting look in her eye. She's got flowers in her skirt, which
dropping. It's beautiful.
And she's skipping. Mm-hmm. And she's a darling little girl.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's funny because Lawrence is a painter I dearly, dearly love. And I think Susan and I both share that. And Susan's worked with a lot of Lawrence's in her career. But I didn't think I was going to like the picture. I honestly didn't. And I really like her so much better after having lived with her for a while, for all those reasons that Susan says. And that's one of the, we change our own minds about the artwork based upon, you know, our exposure to it.
Do you have a favorite in the exhibition?
Oh, yes, I do. I love this. I love the painting that I'm going to mention. It was not part of the Iva bequest, but it is part of the Kenwood collection. And I think that's worth pointing out that Kenwood, like other institutions, has a organic history. So you have to go and see the full panoply of the collections when it reopens. And it's a marvelous experience. But the painting I love, Joseph Wright of Derby, Dressing Dolls, showing two little girls by candlelight who have undressed their doll and decided that it's much more fun to dress the cat. And, you know, who hasn't looked at a cat and looked at some doll clothes or baby clothes and said, I want to try this? There's just something about the little armholes that you think paws will look good being pushed through. And, of course, the cat never thinks it's a good idea. And the cat in this picture, his tail is the cat's tail is sticking out. And he looks, you know, the cat's looking right at the viewer. And you know it's going to end badly with scratches and tears. But it's a marvelous, marvelous picture because of that universality, at least with my childhood. And the sequel would be the scratches and the cat hiding under the porch. But also it's a fascinating picture because it's a picture about learning. It's a picture about empirical knowledge, I would argue, which is very much bound up with the 18th century and Wright of Derby's experience. But I love the picture. It's actually a little ghoulish and creepy, too. And so it's perfect for Halloween.
Do you have cats?
Oh, yes, I have a cat. I grew up with cats. I have a cat. I have two dogs and a cat. And let me tell you, for those of you who want to dress up animals, it's easier to dress up dogs. They will take it. They will let you do it. The cat will not. And if you like dogs, let's get off my own menagerie. If you like dogs, there are fabulous paintings for you in this show, including two extraordinary Gainsboroughs, violent Gainsboroughs, showing dogs going about their sort of animal instincts, but they're beautifully painted. And yes, if you're an animal lover, we have things for you in the exhibition.
Oh, I wish you had brought your doggies all dressed up today. That would have been so much fun. It would have. Let's talk about children just a little more, because this must have been a big thing in that time to paint children, because there are a lot of portraits of children. Some of them are kind of strange and some of them are straightforward. And I love the one that you love too, Susan. It's a beautiful portrait. Tell us about children in portraits at this time and as being part of the collection.
Edward Guinness had three sons, and he obviously loved children, so he collected a lot of paintings of children. The children were painted because they were the heirs, they were the legacy. I mean, it was important if you're putting together a picture collection that you would have your heir painted. Reynolds, there's a portrait by Reynolds of two very beautiful, mature-looking children, John and Juliana Angerstein, painted for their father, commissioned by their father, John Julius Angerstein, who was an important picture collector in his own right and helped found London's National Gallery. And their mother died the year that it was painted. So it's kind of almost a soulful painting, very beautifully put together. And to me, sort of exhibits a sort of tenderness and a care that their father was showing by commissioning the work in the first place. I know William has some very interesting theories about the development of children's portraiture in the 18th century. So I'll let him explain those to you.
Yes, I mean, very basically, if you look at pictures of children from earlier centuries, often you'll notice there's these sort of stiff little doll-like figures who are dressed up in adult clothing. And we do see a change in art, I would argue, in the 18th, particularly in the 18th century and into the 19th century, which I believe relates to changing ideas about childhood itself, which is coming out of writers like Jean-Jacques Rousseau in France and David Hume in Great Britain. So there's the modern conception of childhood develops, where children are not little adults. They actually are people who develop and grow and we as adults have, not particularly as parents, have an obligation to nurture them and to be part of their lives and to think about what they're learning and how they're learning and the different stages of their development. I mean, in French art, for example, you see an explosion in the later part of the 18th century of images of aristocratic women breastfeeding. And if you don't understand that concept and why women are suddenly representing themselves nursing as opposed to previously when your wet nurse would do it if you were of a certain social standing, you don't understand why that works. And in the show, we thought we would concentrate these images of children because it is true. There are portraits like the Reynolds portrait of the Angerstein children that are very tender and beautiful, and portraits like the Lawrence of Miss Murray, where she's a child. She is being a child. She's skipping and playing, and it's all about that sort of impish, winsome personality. There's not necessarily a moral lesson there. It's a little girl being able to be a little girl, or Rite of Darby, who shows mischievous, curious children doing something that is very specifically childlike. Again, playing with a cat and playing with dolls. So it's fascinating to me to look at 18th century portraiture, in particular into the early 19th century, and really to see what I think of as a shift in the ideas of how children should be portrayed.
Oh, that was fascinating. That's good information to have before you see the exhibit. You see it in a different way. We welcome more phone calls. If you'd like to join our conversation, if you've seen the exhibit, if you haven't and you have questions about it or comments about the museum, we would love to hear from you. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Susan Jenkins, senior curator at the English Heritage Foundation. William Rudolph, who is curator of American art and decorative arts at the Milwaukee Art Museum, our guest this hour. And we're talking about the current exhibit at the Milwaukee Art Museum, which opened on October 12 and runs through January 13. Rembrandt Van Dyck, Gainsborough, The Treasures of Kenwood House, 48 masterpieces that have never been outside of England, and you have a rare chance to see them here in Milwaukee. We also are going to give you a chance. We're going to, the Art Museum has generously said that they will give us two tickets, so we decided the way to do this. If you'd like to go, go to talk@wpr.org and say, I'd like the tickets, or whatever you'd like to say. And then we'll gather all of those and we'll do a drawing. This only goes until 10 o'clock today. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hour two of our program today, Nate Silver will be joining us. He does that 5:38 column for the New York Times and blogs frequently on elections. The Signal in the Noise is his latest book, Why So Many Predictions Fail, But Some Don't. Nate Silver with us. Hour two of our program this Thursday. Our phone number, if you'd like to join this conversation, is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. You can also, I forgot to tell you this, but post on our Facebook page as well, because we like to hear, we like to read the comments. And you like to read each other's comments, too. It's a good way to communicate. Judy in Sorona. Hi, Judy.
Oh, hi. How are you?
Fine, Judy.
I'm just enjoying your program so much because I went to Kenwood House in the 90s, and I was quite by accident, and someone said, why don't you go there? And it's on the most beautiful hilltop there. The foyer is just gigantic, the huge cauldrons, and the library, if they could talk about the library, are they going to be doing anything different to the library? How are they going to refurbish this? Anyone who gets a chance, please go to Kenwood House in London. It's just fabulous. I the different paintings, the music room, the huge harp that they have there, and Lady Gray. It's just beautiful, absolutely gorgeous.
Susan.
Well, Judy, thank you so much. I'm so glad you've gone. And do come back when we reopen, but not till the end of October next year. You asked about the refurbishment of the presentation program for the library. Yes, the house is closed, as I said, for re-roofing, and we're representing all the interiors. So we're working very hard on the Robert Adam interiors that include the great room or library. And that's a very, very important part of the representation program. We have been doing paint analysis to check what the original paint scheme that Robert Adam put on for the first Earl of Mansfield was. And it seems that it was really very, very different from what we have at the moment. And there's a lot of gilding in the library that was not there under the first scheme. So that's a big piece of work to investigate and determine. And then the furnishing was completely different. There was much more furniture. Lord Mansfield used the room as an entertaining space. It wasn't simply a library. It was also called the Great Room because it was the largest room at Kenwood, where he, as a very important attorney, he was our attorney general, sort of most important lawmaker, he would entertain all his friends out of town, out of his London base, sort of, you know, in his wonderful house of Hampstead Heath. So he had a lot of chairs and tables and occasional tables, and it was beautifully furnished, and we are hoping to bring back as many objects as we can from that era and give people a sense of the life and the use of the room then.
And how do you determine, Susan, the color of the walls? When you say things were quite different than you thought for a long time, I assume, that they had been. How do you determine that?
We employ scientists. There are certain specialized companies that do paint scrapes or paint analysis. Mm. They take a cross-section through the different layers, and they examine it under the microscope, and they sometimes send the pigments to a laboratory to be examined. And then they build up a sense of the structure. So you get a sort of chart that shows you what the bottom layer was and when the first layers of gilding were. And the bits of dirt between the layers in a kind of a sandwich, you can then tell roughly what date they were applied. So we've had that process by the University of Lincoln, a company who's done that for us.
Judy, thank you so much for the call. William is next in Lodi. Hi, William.
Not near my house.
William, are you there? No. Okay. Sorry. All right, I thought he was there. In the process of all of these treasures, I'm always interested in how hard it is to have them go and how you sit on this end of the big pond and anticipate their arriving and the great care that you must take with these very valuable, in so many ways, treasures.
Well, every exhibition is a complex logistical exercise, figuring out how things get from point A to point B and all stops in between safely, accurately, and of course, we have to say, as economically as possible without sacrificing any of the care. And I think Susan and I would both agree that we were incredibly fortunate to have as the organizing partner, American Federation of Arts in New York, which is about a 103-year-old institution that specializes in putting together exhibitions. And it's a marvelous team of people. I worked with them during the installation. They were supervising the unpacking of works, and a conservator was also in from English Heritage, who carefully looked over everything. So there are always very dedicated professional people who do their best to ensure that the works of art travel safely, that everything is fine with them. And then I also have to give a great shout out to my wonderful team of preparators at the Milwaukee Art Museum. They are responsible for hanging the art and moving the art both in our permanent collection galleries every day and in special exhibitions. They're a great team of people, and they are very sensitive to handling and to placement. They always have opinions, and their opinions are frequently very good. But that's part of the fascinating backstory, as you acknowledge, Kathleen, of just the whole logistical puzzle, the game of how to move these things. And sometimes there's a little bit of nail-biting just because you do think about everything that could possibly go wrong. And thank goodness nothing has gone wrong because people are so good at what they do.
Yes, you can tell great care has gone into all aspects of this. Is it hard to say goodbye to the masterpieces for a period of time? Susan?
Yeah, it certainly is. And I would just like to second what William said. Safety and security are the two kind of paramount concerns that we have. The fact that the house is closed and that you know, they would be in store if they were touring the States means that I am so thrilled to introduce them to a new audience and also one that's so appreciative. I have been loving my time here, but I've been loving the fact that your audiences can engage with a very important collection that complements the collection that the Milwaukee Art Museum has and offers extra additional and important works. I did want to say one thing, that there's a painting that hasn't been able to travel because its condition has not allowed it to, and it's a work by Vermeer of a young girl playing a guitar. It went as far as our National Gallery in London, which is very close to Kenwood, and it's a very good reason for you to come to see Kenwood when it reopens, because it's a painting that's one of our masterpieces that you know, can entice you to go and see your old friends and some new ones when it goes back.
And it's also part of the wonderful story that Susan mentioned about the history of collecting. So in the late 19th century, Rembrandt's star is suddenly on the rise. And Vermeer, of course, is one of the great 19th century rediscoveries in art history. And there's quite a lot of competition to acquire works of art by Vermeer. And some people, of course, get the short end of the stick in terms of they don't really get a real Vermeer, as we find out later. But Kenwood definitely got one. It's a marvelous, marvelous painting. So I second that. You have to see her in situ, as it were, because it's just one of the stars of the collection.
Well, congratulations to both of you and all the people involved. The exhibit is just wonderful. And thank you for being with us this hour.
Thank you. Enjoyed it.
Thank you so much. Susan Jenkins joining us by phone from New York, which is where she is now, but she was in Milwaukee for a few days, curator at English Heritage since 2005 and curator of this exhibit. We also have in our studios William Rudolph, and William is curator of American art and decorative arts at the Milwaukee Art Museum. Just for a couple more minutes, if you would like to see this exhibit, the Art Museum has two tickets, and if you go to our talk at WPR.org and say why you want the tickets or your name, we'll just put it in a drawing, and that's only for the next couple minutes, and we'll be happy to have a couple of you go to this exhibit, but all of you should see it. It's terrific. Thanks to Brett Jaspers and Rhonda Fanning, who produced this program. We'll return.